Well, thanks very much, Sam, and thank you very much to the organisers, to the Melbourne Institute and the Australian newspaper for the opportunity to speak to this group about such an important topic. The central concern that was flagged as a theme for this session is whether the post-crisis regulatory reform program has distorted provision of finance in this country in a way that impedes our growth prospects. So I'd like first to talk about those reforms before moving on to discuss what they mean for how economic activity in Australia is financed. The crisis showed that the global regulatory structure existing at the time was not delivering the degree of system safety that society expected or wanted. Australia had already built a bit more conservatism into its prudential framework than the global minimum standard. So did some other countries that were less affected by the crisis. I would argue that events have vindicated that choice, not to eliminate risk entirely, but to manage it appropriately. In a couple of respects, the Basel III package of reforms to global banking regulation represented a catch-up to where Australia and some other countries already were. The post-crisis reform program goes well beyond the Basel standards and making banking safer. Far-reaching reforms have also been implemented or proposed in areas of over-the-counter derivatives trading, resolution of failing financial intermediaries, and the so-called shadow banking system outside the perimeter of prudential regulation. These are the four areas that Australia has advocated focusing on in its G20 presidency year. And Barry Stirland will have more to say about the G20 regulatory reform agenda later in this session. There's still some work to do to implement some of these agreed reforms. But the Australian authorities have taken the view that any new initiatives from here cannot really be described as necessary responses to the crisis. The global regulatory community needs to set a high bar for proposals beyond what's already been agreed. If the Australian authorities have limited appetite for continually adding to the reform program, we have even less appetite for rolling it back. A return to the pre-crisis setup would be a mistake. Australia went into the crisis with a financial system that was better placed to handle the shocks than some other systems were. But there were some things that could have been better and have since improved. Consumer protection rules now cover a wider range of loan types. Funding structures in banking now better reflect liquidity risks. The authorities have some more effective ways to resolve financial firms if they do fail. And protection for depositors has been strengthened and clarified. And those are just a few examples of the work that's been done in recent years. The Australian authorities have been actively engaged in developing the post-crisis reforms. In doing so, we've worked to ensure that global reforms can still fit local conditions. We're just one voice among many, and a fairly small one at that. Even so, our efforts have met with some success. For example, the new Basel liquidity rules needed to be workable in countries like Australia, where there's not much government debt. Partly because of the efforts of the Australian authorities, an option was added to allow banks to meet the liquidity coverage ratio using a committed liquidity facility with the central bank. And several other countries in a similar situation will be using a similar approach. Tailoring global rules for local conditions is a very different thing from ignoring them entirely. Walking away from these global reforms is not an option for Australia. Australian financial firms play in the global financial system. They diversify their investor base by tapping global markets. So they need to be able to show that they meet the minimum standards that the global market expects. For banks, that includes the Basel III package. And the Basel III package was always contemplated that banking systems that could meet the new capital requirements ahead of the deadline should do so. Other financial firms and infrastructure will also need to meet the global standards relevant to them. Setting up global regulation takes time and effort. So does complying with new regulation. But harmonising global financial regulatory standards surely benefits firms with business in many countries, compared with the alternative of each country going entirely their own way. I can't help noticing that there's been less attention given to harmonising regulation globally for other industries where the suppliers are also often global firms and the customers are also generally local households and businesses. Pharmaceuticals, household cleaning products, and children's toys and car seats are all markets with substantial market shares going to global producers. Safety matters a great deal for all of these products. Yet there's no Basel Committee for Cleaning Products regulation. We don't have information sharing arrangements or common rules for over-the-counter medications the way we do for over-the-counter derivatives. Those industries just have to wear the costs of complying with national regulation. Now, part of the reason for the difference is that if something does go wrong in one country, there's not the same spillover to other countries, the way there is in finance. Financial regulatory gaps and lapses in other countries can hurt us, as the financial crisis showed. It's in all countries' interests to cooperate on regulatory standards and promoting financial stability. Regulators cooperate for the benefit of the people of their countries, not for the benefit of the regulated firms. Complying with regulation does take effort, though, and absorbs resources that could be used for something else. Regulators do need to be mindful about compliance burdens. But the regulated entities also need to be alert to inefficiencies in their approach to compliance. If the imperative to comply with new regulation were to spur a rethink of outmoded business practices or inefficient systems, that could be a good outcome. With a reform program as extensive as the post-crisis reforms have been, it's natural to wonder if there might be some unintended consequences. In the lead-up to the crisis, it was apparent that, globally, risk was being underpriced. By implication, credit was too easily available. Some of that did spill over to Australia, most notably for business credit, which over 2007 expanded at an annual rate of over 20%. Even now, it seems that the price of risk has again declined to low levels, though not quite as low as in early 2007. Volatility in financial markets is also quite low at the moment. Some market participants might again have become complacent about the risks they're taking. Policymakers are rightly wary of excessively exuberant credit supply. But at the same time, it would be unfortunate if the post-crisis policy responses had the effect of restricting credit supply too much and of shutting out worthy borrowers. The text in the conference program introducing this session exemplifies this concern about financing economic activity. Banks, it claimed, are being turned into glorified building societies, lending for mortgages and not much else. I don't think that's a completely accurate characterisation, actually, but it is a claim we should take seriously. In asking what the post-crisis reform program has meant for particular sectors, we need to be mindful of an important principle: that bank capital should be allocated according to risk. If a particular loan or other asset is riskier, then banks need to hold more capital against that asset than they must hold against a less risky asset. Lending to business is riskier than mortgage lending to households. Now, the US experience has shown that it is possible to have a bad outcome on mortgage lending, even before an economic calamity rather than as part of one. But the breakdown in lending standards you need to get that kind of outcome is pretty extreme. The losses on mortgage lending over decades and across many countries are simply lower than losses on business lending, and that's remained true outside the US most recently. Other episodes of losses on mortgage portfolios have generally been the result of an economic downturn, not the cause of it. That is the evidence. The evidence is also that finance for small business in Australia was not particularly badly hit by the crisis. Bank lending to unincorporated businesses, that is, sole traders and partnerships, held up better than lending to the corporate sector in the post-crisis period. It was the foreign bank branches that, as a group, contracted their lending most. They normally lend to the big end of town, more so than to small business and start-up ventures. Now, the concerns about availability of finance for small business hark back to some of the complaints one used to hear about the banks in the 1970s and 1980s, at least if you went to my family's Christmas dinners. Banks wouldn't support innovative Australian business, went the story. So these businesses had to move offshore to get funding. When it came down to it, most of these complaints seemed to be about the rotary engine. But underneath it all was a legitimate concern. Start-up businesses, innovation and entrepreneurship are all a large part of what society needs to move forward and raise living standards. Yet they're also inherently risky propositions. Many new businesses fail. Their creditors will make losses. And if something is a riskier proposition, lenders ought to hold more capital against the loan than against something safer. That is as it should be. But more than that, maybe that business shouldn't be funded with debt, or at least not entirely so. Such businesses might be better funded by equity-type finance that allows for an unprofitable build-up phase of the business and that it can absorb the anticipated volatility in product profit. But that kind of investment isn't a loan, and it isn't the kind of asset that should dominate the balance sheet of a bank. Remember that banks accept deposits. There's a huge social value in having some kind of asset that people can trust in, so that value will be there when they come to make payments. As a society, we've decided that private entities should be able to offer such a safe asset. But if their liabilities are to be so safe and so liquid, they must be regulated and supervised appropriately. Part of that regulation and supervision is designed to limit the riskiness of the assets backing those deposit liabilities. So rather than looking to banks for loans, perhaps new businesses need finance that looks more like venture capital. The bank raised similar issues in its submission to the Financial System Inquiry. Over the years, there's been a lot of attention and many parliamentary inquiries given to the level of competition in the residential mortgage market. But as we said in that submission, the supply of mortgage finance is ample. There is no need for new policies that would advantage lending for that purpose. If there are structural impediments to competition in finance, they're more likely to manifest in small business finance. Unlike larger corporations, small business does not have access to non-intermediated market alternatives, especially global bond markets. There are things that can be done to improve the infrastructure in the capital market, but there will be limits to how much difference this will make for start-up firms. Someone would still have to perform a credit assessment on those firms and evaluate their business plans. This is costly, bespoke work where relationship banking provides an information advantage. So there are some impediments to debt financing of small business, but I doubt that the post-crisis reform packages have made them any worse. There's nothing in the Basel III package that makes housing finance relatively more attractive compared with other lending than was already the case in Basel II and before. And those relativities are designed, however imperfectly, to reflect risk. The exact numbers in those risk weightings have changed over time, but the relativities have not. It should also be remembered that some of the additional conservatism in Australia's prudential framework is precisely in this area. APRA set the local rules to require banks using their own models to hold more capital against housing mortgages than a plain vanilla version of the Basel standards would require. Banks in some other countries actually hold much less capital against mortgages than the big banks here do. It could perhaps be argued that Australia should go further and be even more conservative in its treatment of housing finance. That would, of course, make mortgages more expensive and less available than they would otherwise be. Whether and how far to go in this direction is something the Financial System Inquiry may want to examine. The upshot of all of this is that banks have advantage in assessing creditworthiness that financial markets cannot completely replicate. So banks will probably always play an important role in financing small and new businesses. Because they take deposits, though, they need to ensure that their assets are not too risky and that they hold sufficient capital for the risks they do run. So they probably cannot be the only source of finance for these ventures. If there is a segment of business finance that's riskier, perhaps much of it should be structured more like equity than debt. It therefore probably needs to come from another class of investor, not prudentially regulated deposit-taking banks, credit unions and building societies. In Australia, the superannuation sector more or less equals the banking system in size. Its asset base includes a lot of equity exposures. It is a sector that clearly can take some investment risk. So some observers naturally wonder if the superannuation sector could somehow be induced to direct its funds in ways that fulfil various sector goals, various social goals, and perceived funding needs. But as the bank pointed out in its submission to the Financial System Inquiry, the goal of the superannuation system is to provide retirement incomes for its beneficiaries. Superannuation assets should be managed in the best interests of fund members. Their allocation should not be distorted in the pursuit of other ends. The availability of appropriately structured finance is an important issue for the Financial System Inquiry to consider. The committee will be releasing an interim report in coming weeks. I don't want to speculate on what that report contains or make suggestions for what it should contain, given that the text has presumably already been finalised. If I look back at the bank's submission, though, I see a few other themes that I hope the inquiry has examined further. One important issue relates to Australia's superannuation system, namely its cost and pricing. Analysis from several sources suggests that at least some parts of the sector incur costs and charge fees that are quite high compared with other countries. There's no social benefit to paying more for the same funds management services. Every dollar that's paid in fees to trustees, fund managers, and all the other layers of the industry is a dollar that's not going into Australians' retirement savings. I'm pleased to see that Treasury has recently taken up that particular issue as well. To conclude, public policy needs to ensure that the stability and safety of the financial system meets society's actual expectations. It also needs to ensure that this stability is not at the expense of the innovation and entrepreneurship that can raise living standards. The objective is not to eliminate all risk, but those risks need to be structured in ways that limit the chance of a systemically bad outcome. They also need to be allocated to those parties best able to bear them. In large part, that's what the post-crisis reform program has been designed to do. And thank you for your time.
Let me open up to some questions. So the lady on the right first, please.
Hi, it's Pip Freeburn from the Australian Industry Group. Excuse my speech impediment at the moment. I'm just interested, perhaps it's a little bit cheeky, for Lucy and Barry to give us their view on future of financial advice reforms and what's happened at Commonwealth Bank the past week. And following from Carsten's comments...
You know, it'd be hard, if just intermeet, I mean, it's hard for Lucy, being from the bank, to speak. But anyway, let me
Firstly, nice to see you again, Pip. Pip's a okay, former colleague. I didn't realise you'd ended up at AIG, so it's nice to see you again. I think what I can say, I mean, rather than talking about the specifics, I think something I spoke about at a speech about 2 years ago, where one of the hooks that we can... There are sort of two hooks we can use to see where there might be a bad outcome later on, and one is risk-taking and one is rent-seeking. And the provision of financial advice and expert advice is clearly one where rent-seeking is an issue. And we did touch on this in our Financial Stability Inquiry submission when we talked about the cost... The cost involved in the retirement income system, much of which is because of the different layers of advice and the changing rules and, you know, how to get your tax. But, you know, there just seem to be an awful lot of people who are very happy to provide you advice, and there have been concerns about conflicts, and you're paying a lot of money to get conflicted advice. And so it is an important area to get right, and I think it speaks to a general principle that we would point to, which is... look for opportunities to rent seek within any industry, and that is something you may wish to focus on in terms of your regulatory response.
So the question's about whether we have the superannuation system we need and adequacy. Do you have any thoughts about how the superannuation system's connected to stability? Because we're really here to talk a lot about stability. Do you think, you know, Australia does have a very advanced and unique superannuation system. The fact that we have portable super, I think, makes us quite different to anyone, really. We have an almost completely defined contribution system, which has stability implications itself. But just to connect the questions about the super system and the adequacy of the super system to our discussion of stability, do you think that the design of our super system and the way we're going with it, do you think that affects the stability of the Australian financial system? Do you think there's any issues there?
We've done quite a bit of thinking about this, and the way we framed it in the financial system inquiry submission is that it's better to have a great big lump of money funding people's retirement that's unleveraged than that's leveraged. Mm. And I think that one of the key aspects of our system that is distinctive is that we have this big pension system that is defined contribution and unleveraged. And so you don't have the kinds of issues you see in many other countries, for example, in Europe, where they get into real trouble because they've made promises that they then can't keep because they misunderstood or misforecast where inflation was going to go and therefore where nominal interest rates were going to go. So in that sense, you then don't get these errors of these compounding issues of a promise that then can't be met that then causes other reactions that causes assets to be sold off or allocated. So the fact that that is unleveraged is very important. But there are a number of maybe not stability issues, but infrastructure issues that we need to think about in more detail. And one of them is this issue of portability. It's great that we have a system that doesn't lock people into particular employers at risk of losing their pension, because, of course, that's very good for the flexibility of the labour market and therefore the household sector's ability to withstand shocks. But it does mean that the superannuation funds have to manage liquidity in a way they wouldn't otherwise have to do, and that's just an issue that has to be dealt with. And similarly, again, coming back to the cost, this is intended to accumulate retirement savings for people, but the fee structure is quite high relative to current returns, right. And so you do get this squeeze during periods of relatively low returns in financial markets. So that's really quite important. And, of course, there are important infrastructure things you need to think about, like who the trustees are, who the custodians are, and that, so in terms of resolution and too big to fail and how you resolve a very complex financial firm and, what happens if they have a whole bunch of client funds. And these are things that we just do have to be sorted out and thought about. And we're not going to pretend that we have all the answers as yet, but it's certainly something that we've done a lot of thinking about over recent years.